So thanks for doing this, Dave. I know from your Twitter feed you do about 6 interviews a day at the moment. So I don't know whether you're going to be amazing or you're going to be so bored of forever telling your story that it's going to be painful. But how many have you done today?
Oh, I haven't done one today.
Oh, it's the first today.
Yeah, no, I've got about
there forever
one.
Seems to be camera crews.
Yeah, it has been pretty full on, but in a good way. I mean, I always say to everyone, like, be worried when they don't want to come.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, unfortunately, this one is going to drag you down into your murky past of advertising as well. So you probably haven't covered that much.
I haven't, actually.
Have you not? Okay.
No.
So I've got to start by saying, where were you born?
Okay. I was born in Pukekohe, which is in New Zealand, North Island. And
you were born in New Zealand?
Yeah, my parents.
Sort of I didn't know that.
Yeah, out there. And then had... 3 kids out there, and then decided that my mum just got went to New Zealand and said, actually, God, it's really like Wales, but not Wales.
And your mum was from Wales, presumably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, came back. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, and that was in the Cardigan Bay area, I'm imagining.
Actually, it's about 2 hours away. We were brought up in the Romney Valleys, so. And we got to know Cardigan because Claire's mum and dad had a caravan, and we, got to know it over a period of time. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, what was the first ad you can ever remember seeing?
Oh, well, I don't think it was an ad, but I mean, my bedroom, much to my mother's dismay, was apart from the windows. And apart from the door handle, it was Adidas posters, Puma posters, Nike posters, Levi's posters, Wrangler posters. And including the ceiling was all these posters. And I had to get all these posters free. So
I was what, just from magazines? Up. You'd send off for
well,
a free
no,
poster?
I'd send off from the companies, and I'd send them off ideas, and they'd send me posters.
Are you kidding?
It was my way to get posters and stickers. So.
What, you would essentially write ads, send it to them, and they'd give you a free poster?
Yeah.
How old were you at this point?
I don't know, 13, 12 or something, yeah. I was just into it, so.
Wow. I wonder why that particular category, which has ended up obviously being what you're in now.
I guess I was a football fan, so, and like football boots, and I was just intrigued by like, why certain players would wear certain boots, and I used to literally at one point I knew what every player like wore. Do you mean
right.
Like I knew every, like almost I don't know it now, but I used to know it. I was just going like, God, he's just swapped from Adidas to not so much Nike then, but other brands.
Umbra or whatever it would have been.
Yeah, well, Gola and in the very early days.
I wonder what got you. I wonder what. That seems so geeky and so unusual. I wonder what.
And I could tell you, was it Adidasler, came up with this screw boot and, in the 1954 World Cup.
So, how would you have found that sort of stuff out then? Because obviously that's pre internet.
I used to put a tie on. I used to blag my way into these sports trade shows. I was never let on the big stands like Adidas because they always appointments only. But I used to get all the manuals and catalogs, and I used to come home. I used to literally not be able to like my back was in half because I was carrying all these books, and I used to just devour literally all the information. I was just into it.
Was that with a view of moving into that as a job, or that was just what you loved at the time?
I even considered jobs. I was just going, I'm into this, and I just had got all the data. I think we're just a bit geeky. I remember, my brother, he's almost spent 2 years on a sofa, didn't move, read everything he could about auto sport and motor racing, and then he put an ad in the back of Autosport Weekly and said, I'll work anywhere, any place, any time, as long as it's motor racing. And Sir Jack Brabham phoned him up.
Wow.
So I think we're just geeky on different things. So and he got a job in motor racing. And,
yeah. From his ad?
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Like so Jack Braben phoned him up and was like, but I mean, and I did the same in terms of like that world. I literally knew I had scrapbooks. I mean, you know, we've talked about scrapbooks before, but I used to have scrapbooks on every, you know, like ad or every different team signed for, you know, Adidas or Umbro. I was just really like geeky on it.
And
to the point I was getting, you know, Welsh rugby players, I'd get, you know, going like, get them to wear Patrick boots and like all sorts of, I can't mean now if I think about it, it's just, what the hell was I doing?
Say that again, you were...
But I got some of the Welsh rugby union players, I mean, they weren't paid at the time, so I was like getting them to wear certain boots and things, and you know, like I was a little kid.
What do you mean, how did that work? What, you, well, on mean, behalf just, of Patrick? I remember that brand, Patrick.
I mean, I was just going, I said to Patrick, I can get all these players to wear them. And all of a sudden, you know, I can't say which players, but like suddenly they were wearing Patrick boots. And I was like, oh, I did that.
And how old were you at the time?
Like 13, 14, maybe 15.
Like a little Doogie Howser.
Yeah, yeah. And I did that with Lecoq Sportif thing, and like, I said that you should put your logo on the back of you know, the numbers, and they did it, and they were the first company to do it, and, on the football strips. And I was, I don't know why, I was just kind of like, I literally go out, you know, go up to the brand that doesn't exist anymore, Buckter, and say, like, if you don't do all these things, you know, you probably won't exist. And they went, oh, thank you very much.
So, why? Why didn't you gravitate towards that when you left school?
Well, I tried. I borrowed, borrowed 500 quid from my dad. I mean, he wasn't like a rich man, and so there was a lot of his savings. And you know, like, I tried to start something at 16. I didn't do my A levels, and you know, within 6 months, I was out of business and bankrupt, and going, oh fuck, okay. It's not so good.
And what was the plan then? What was the business?
Well, it was selling, you know, Nike, Adidas, you know, all these like big brands, but like discontinued lines, so they'd be a lot cheaper. Like my dad said, like, well, like, I had to go and tell him. So look, you know, lost all the money. And he said, well, what did you learn? And I said, well, I said, well, I learned I loved it. And he said, well, the next step is to learn how to be good at it.
Right.
Going, okay.
So what happened between then and going to college to on an ad
well,
course?
Well, I kind of had to go and, go back, you know, to college, do my A-levels in 1 year, like, and I sort of worked pretty hard, got them. I went, like, you know, I was revising, doing work, going running, trying to forget about revising, and then go and revise more, then go running the next day. And so I got my grades, went to Bristol College, like, didn't do any work because I'd worked so hard in that previous year, and got thrown out quite rightly. And then I was going, oh, actually, what am I going to do now? And it's kind of interesting. I mean, I literally remember, like, this is how old I am. Like, is I was in a telephone box, which don't exist anymore, and phoning my mum and going, oh, I've been kicked out, and so I'm going to come home. She was going, oh, okay, well, and then, like, she bought me a book, and it was terrible, and I took it back to W.H. Smith, and, I found this book, you know, Ogilvy on Advertising.
Wow, that's the first book I got on advertising too.
And I just read it, and I read it, and I read it, and I must have read it, I don't know how many times. And there was a bit about creative department, and, you know, they didn't, you know, need any qualifications or something. And I'm going, right, that's the thing. I haven't got any qualifications. I like ideas.
A match made in heaven.
Yeah.
Funny, because that's the first book that I got on advertising. Similar thing.
Yeah.
And I can remember pictures of Ogilvy's chateau.
Yeah, I remember that, and the clock ad, and
The Rolls Royce.
Yeah. And it just completely opened my eyes. I'm going, oh, there's, you can get that job where you can just do ideas. And I'm going, oh, that's a good job. Let's go do that.
So then you applied to, was it Hounslow you went to?
No, I didn't go to like any sort of college. I mean, I was on the like dole for a year and a half. We did about 150 different interviews, and
so like, when you say we, who was that? I thought you
well,
were.
Well, I mean, I did it with. I teamed up pretty early on when we were like in London with Ajab, right. Samurai Singh, bless him, and you know, we literally toured the circuit trying to get a job like anywhere. And it was, I mean, you know, like our book wasn't very good. Then it got quite good. Then it got pretty good. And then eventually it was good enough to get a job. But it took us a year and a half to get it to that one.
So where did you want to be? Were you one of the Dave Trott disciples?
Well, I liked what, like, yeah, I mean, I think at that time GDT was the place. But I also liked FCO. A talk which is in Midori House, which is where Monocle magazine is now, and it, you know, he did a talk on Nike, and he said that he was literally like his least paying client, and his entire staff were just working on it like day and night to do great stuff. And actually, they did really great stuff at the beginning.
Yeah, Nike Macaro swears by them, and
yeah,
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, it was that went through many iterations, I think.
Was that Ian Potter gave a talk?
Yeah, Ian Potter.
Funny, yeah. Both FTO and Ian Potter are sort of completely forgotten, but they were a great agency at the time.
It was a great agency, and they did really like quite. I mean, like Nike at that point was very like. Purist running only running, and they did great stuff, and like nobody knew them in this country. Do you mean it was? It's not the company we know now.
No, absolutely. So, did you go to that talk because of your love of sports footwear rather than advertising?
Yeah. I was just going. Well, it's actually two things. I'm going like it's advertising, and he's going to talk about Nike. So I'm going. I'll take that all day long.
So that only strengthened your resolve to get into advertising,
seeing what
they were doing.
Yeah.
So then, did you do any placements or get straight into Sartis?
We couldn't actually get to the... It was really odd. We kind of, like, we worked really hard. I mean, our book was obviously not very good at the beginning and got, you know, half-decent towards the end. But we kind of, like, didn't seem to, like, have any luck with any placements. I think we had one, like, towards the very end with, you know, FCB.
Right.
And that was over a year of trying. We eventually got one, I think that was the only one we had, and we just couldn't, like, for the life of us, couldn't get anyone. I think placements seem to be more set up for like the colleges and stuff, and you know, colleges are pretty good at getting their students in there, and that's great. But we found it a bit hard to burst our bubble, really.
So how did you get into Sartis? Because I remember I went for an interview once at Sartis, and I think I've mentioned this before, and with Mike McKenna.
Yeah.
And when we were waiting to see Paul Arden, someone said, good luck. He took on a team last week, but they brought in a live sheep with them to the interview, and he loved that. So obviously we felt like a couple of squares sitting there sheepless and with just a book. But and that would have been a similar time. So how did you see Arden? Was that your?
I think we'd somehow like got in there, not so much as like a placement or something. We just got a room. I think we were seeing. Well, there's two stories. One, I initially made it like an impression at Saatchi's in when I was on my own. I went down to the FT and got some paper, and then I went and bought some letter set, and then I sort of snuck in through reception and said I had to make a delivery to Jeff Stark.
Right.
And at the time, there were some famous ads for YTS.
And I remember those, yeah.
And I did my version of that ad, basically saying, you should hire me. But I sort of cut out his ad on the FT, and I put it on his desk. And then you know, it was pretty early in the morning, so there was nobody in the creative department. Then I snuck back out. And then at 11 o'clock in the morning, I phoned up and said, oh, you know, what did Jeff think of my ad? And the girl laughed, said, oh, it's you, is it? And I'm going, you know, you should come in. He saw my book, and it was terrible. But he's going, look, actually, you obviously got some initiative. So I think I became on their radar then. Then when I teamed up with Ajab, we saw Simon Dickett, who actually was like very articulate about why something didn't work, and actually he was really sort of he was really kind of interesting because he's a real thinker about the ads and stuff, and that was a really good way for us to make it better. Then eventually I can't remember exactly, but I mean we'd found a room that was either used for storage, and we chucked everything into a cupboard, and we made it our own. And it was at that point they thought maybe we were already hired. And then we came under Tim Mellor's wing, and I think Tim and Tim persuaded Paul that they should give us a job. So it's kind of definitely through the back door we got in.
Hmm. Perfect. So you were in Mellor's group.
Yeah. And Tim was great, actually. Really, I literally remember him, I taken an ad in one day, and he was going, this is terrible. You've really got to stop doing this shit.
He said that.
Yeah, yeah. And he kicked it around the room, and I'm going, oh, my God. I was like, oh, my God, yeah, that is terrible. We need to stop doing that. Yeah, we should do some good stuff. And then he won't kick it around the room. But Tim was very, very human. That doesn't paint a good picture of Tim. He was absolutely brilliant, actually.
In what sense?
Well, I think he was a real human being. He wanted to understand the people in front of him. He was a real, an understander of human beings. I mean, and I think that's what the work he wanted almost to emotionally connect.
Right.
And that was the first, it wasn't just a sell, or you could go... you could sell through, the head, or you could sell through the heart. And he was the first person I'd met who wanted to sell through the heart. And I thought that was a pretty interesting journey.
Mm. That is interesting. Well, it's interesting for a couple of... I've tried to interview Tim. He's the only person who said no so far.
Oh, really?
And partly I'd like to interview him because lots of his work at the time seemed very airy-fairy to me. Whereas in retrospect, it stands up very well because it is much more emotional. And at the time, there wasn't much emotional stuff around. It was all very logical.
Well, and the it is, are you stuff. And
yeah.
At the time, you go, was it really selling better journalism? But it was in selling independence, of course. But it was trying to get to you to make you feel something. And that was pretty, and it does stand up, actually.
It does. I mean, funnily enough, I tweeted that last week, that campaign.
Yeah.
Now, usefully, from this period, I've tracked down an old interview from you at the time. Here's the first observation. You're wearing double denim.
Oh, yeah.
Denim.
I literally know the one. It was Craig Review.
That's the one.
Yeah, yeah.
Denim jeans, obviously, and a denim shirt, which is ironic, given where you are. So here's what Tim said. He said they're work junkies, they're a bit aggressive, but they've realised this business is all about flogging things. Quite unusual. Most creatives think it's about airy fairy arty farty stuff.
Okay.
So that's what he said about you. It's quite interesting, A, that it seemed to me at the time he did airy fairy arty stuff, which I think in retrospect was wrong, but he says a bit aggressive, which doesn't sound like you at all. So did you have to be more aggressive in that environment?
I think aggressive in terms of chasing work. Like, because, like, you know, we were Johnny Juniors. Nobody really wanted to give us work. And, you know, we would, like, I would go on, you know, we would, like, go on the, you know, the account floors and go and, like, got any briefs that no one else wants to do. I think we were hungry, and we were definitely, like, we didn't want to sit in a room and just wait. I think when you've been on the dole for a year and a half, you don't like that very much. It's not a nice experience. And the only way, you're there going, you don't want to wait for chances to come. And actually, things like, you know, doing Goodman's in-car stereo stuff, I mean, that was, nobody really wanted to do it. We met an accountant on the stairs, going, got any briefs. He's going, well, I've got something, but, you know, there's not much budget. I'm going, perfect, we'll do it.
And was that quite early on? I think great, that work. I mean, that seems... Probably when you were there, I would say that was probably Saatchi's peak. So creatively, financially, whatever.
Yeah.
They seem so powerful.
Yeah, it was... It's funny, I mean, you know this world better than I do, but, you know, there was a confidence.
Yeah.
I mean, confidence in an agency is important, and when that's lost, it's, everything gets harder. And there was a certain amount of confidence in Saatchi's, and... And when they had that confidence, it was like, it, you know, they were incredibly in their flow, it was interesting to be part of that thing.
So, could you feel that then? Because it's probably, I would have thought, only in retrospect can you sort of gauge that. Did you think this is advertising, or?
I just felt there was a confidence, and it literally went away one day. I think literally when they. Went to buy a bank, that was the moment that, you know, they lost the confidence. And
you felt that then, being there?
Yeah, no, everything was harder the next day, literally harder.
Oh, wow.
It went away. It was a funny, funny thing, and you go, you don't know when you're at your peak, but I think that was literally the next day.
The day before, the way down.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. So that campaign is almost emblematic of that confidence that you've got this scruffy little dodgy low rent car radio manufacturer. I don't know whether I'm doing them justice there, but called Goodman's. I think they're British, aren't they?
Yeah.
So they run this uber cool 48 sheet poster campaign with Helmut Newton shooting erotic pictures of couples in cars for Goodman's. Car, right? I mean, you could only do that at that time in that place, I would imagine. Everyone else would have been doing pictures of radios, desperately telling you how good they are. To do something that bold was.
Yeah, and it got banned 3 days later, and just go, oh my God. Yeah. And but Goodman's loved it because they had so much publicity from it. And Fair Dues, AJAB, went and shot with Helmut Newton. Came back, you know, Paul didn't like the shots. I didn't even go on the shoot. There wasn't enough budget.
Right.
And you know, Paul came in and, I mean, and he's gone, you know, this shit.
Really? This shit. Brilliant.
And I'm going, oh. And like, AJAB was like this, like, I mean, AJAB was so proud of it. And quite rightly, it was an amazing, like, piece of work. And you know, like, Paul wasn't happy. You're going to have to phone him. You know, there's going to be a reshoot. I'm going, all right, Paul, I didn't go on the shoot. Why do I have to phone him? Like,
so did you have to reshoot them?
Well, we didn't. Like, when, like, Paul calmed down and, you know, we...
They looked good to me.
You know, they were amazing. And, because it got banned and never won any awards, but I'm going, Guy, it was definitely a piece of work.
Enter that for a DNA?
You couldn't enter it.
That's good.
I think it got entered, and then it was up for winning something, and then somebody said, hang on, didn't this get banned? And then it got chucked out. So, yeah, and that's the rules, so it's fine.
And I presume that was funded by, you know, one of their big clients who did bad work.
No, I think they actually...
Did Goodman's come up with the cash to pay for that?
Yeah, they paid the cash for it, but knowing that it would probably, it will go up and come down very quickly. And you know, the sell was, this is how much media coverage you're probably going to get. So it was quite calculated, and the client paid, and but it was pretty brave. And the client loved it, to be honest.
Did they really? I think it was great.
Because they had so much publicity. Literally, they're just going, "Oh my god, something going crazy."
So, how was your time with Paul there? Did you have a lot to do with him?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's funny. Like, I mean, I mean, it was hard. I mean, Paul's like, was a very complex character, and you know, and brilliant, and had an intelligence about stuff that he couldn't always articulate. I mean, and so, but we would go down on the weekends and work in his cottage down, I can't remember where it was now, but and we didn't know it at the time. He's, you know, it was going up, but you were the, you know, you were his favorite, so I'm going to really, he definitely didn't tell us that.
It did make you feel like that.
Yeah, never, like literally, we never knew. And but there was a time where he was going to go and leave and start his own agency, and he talked to us about coming with him, and so we must have had a good relationship. And but he's, you know, it's complex. I mean, yeah, we would argue sometimes, and you know, one night, you know, he really pissed me off, and I just, like, I literally went home. I was really pissed off with him because he'd done something, and I didn't say good night to him. And 2 years later, he's gone, you know, he didn't say good night that night. Like, literally, I'm going, oh, Jesus, man. Like, but I really did love him, and I loved working under him. I literally, it was the best, one of the best things that's ever happened to me. Do you mean he was, I felt and still feel like how lucky I was. Do you mean, you know, it's like that thing about, like, you know, like, choose your boss, you know, choose your bosses carefully. And like, for me to be around somebody who was willing to take risks, who was always pushing, like, would be brutally honest, like, sometimes we go, oh my god, okay. But I also get so excited about an idea that he's just like a child would.
So what was the biggest thing you think you learned from Paul, or that you took away once you'd left?
I think it's like that, you know, listening to, like he always listened to, like, even if he couldn't articulate why he liked it, he just went, I just like it. I just know it's right. And his ability to listen to his instinct and gut, and stick to it. I mean, just, and even when other people just go, no, Paul, this one's much much better, he's going, no. This is the one. This is, and he felt it. Mm. And sometimes he couldn't explain it, but he felt it. And so he's going, but, and other people will feel it too. And I'm going, oh god. So to listen to your feeling was an odd thing. And I remember I wrote a line. It was for a whiskey from like a really northern, like one of the far-reaching islands. And I wrote this line. So yes. You know, it's a boss, you know, it's a beautiful whiskey from a bastard of an island,
right?
Because the weather was terrible. And he's going, yeah, I love it. It'll lose the client, but I do love it. And he said, you know, I was saying, well, do you want me to write something else? No, fine. If we're going to do great work,
got to take that risk.
We'll take the risk. And if they don't like it, then we won't do anything else. And you know, he was always like doing that. He was there going, how do we push this thing? And then, you know, like, the interesting thing is with Paul, you know, like, that family tree of people who worked under him have gone on, you know, like, done very interesting things because they had their mentor. Do you mean? And it was like, you know, you literally can't buy that stuff. Do you mean to work under Paul Arden for 7-8 years? You go, wow, amazing.
It's interesting because that's how it seems to me from a distance. You know, you can look at when he turned up at Saatchi's and you look at when he left, and the work was so much better in his period before than after, that that's the only thing that changed. But often you talk to people who used to work with him as his partner, and they're very disparaging, disappointingly, you know, and I don't know why, but Perhaps they thought he got too much credit. I don't know, but
yeah, I think because like he couldn't always articulate what he felt. I mean, I think sometimes that was kind of frustrating for some people. And but you know, the truth is, like, you know, like, the moment he left, the work got worse.
Yeah,
and never reached that pinnacle again. I mean, so and you go. I mean, and, yeah. The other thing is, half the department were glad he left.
Were they?
Yeah. And the other half were like gutted because they knew what they meant, and they knew, you know, that department wouldn't be as good again. The other half wanted an easy life, and you think fine.
Yeah.
But he would push, and he would push, and he would push, and some people, like, you know, they don't like being pushed.
So was Paul the one who gave you and Ajab the nickname Bing and Bong?
I think that was Tim.
Oh, was that Tim?
Yeah. I think nobody can remember our names. I don't know if like half the people like we met there knew our names. I don't think they knew I was David. And I didn't give a shit.
Did you not? Because obviously on the one hand, everybody in London knew there was a team there, an up-and-coming team called Bing and Bong.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you were known as Bing and Bong. So
yeah.
I don't know whether ultimately it was useful because it got you known or whether it was a millstone.
Yeah, I don't know. I was just really interested in doing work. I was just there going, we're going to work the system. Like, you know, nobody thinks we're Johnny Juniors. Let's go and do some work. Then we do some good work and then we get better briefs. And I was so hungry to learn. I didn't give it monkeys about all that stuff. No. I'm just going, fine, whatever.
Useful.
Like, if that makes it stand out, fine. I don't give a shit.
Did you work or come across Charles Saatchi, who's obviously a bit of a recluse?
A little bit. I mean, oddly, like, you know, like my brother would have had, like, maybe more contact with him than I would because he was really into, like, go-kart racing.
Right.
And so my brother would go to the same circuit as him and probably race against him. And so,
okay. Charles Saatchi used to race go-karts?
Yeah. And he'd, you know, go down in his overall. He had a team, like, on 24-hour standby type thing. And
Charles Saatchi?
Yeah. He was really into it. I don't know if you wouldn't know my brother from Adam, but I mean, you know, they used to race against each other. So. But I mean, I met him when we were doing the Conservative campaign. So we'd all go down to Berkeley Square, and I'd done a poster which he loved, which is the L plate Labour, and it was and it researched the best poster they'd ever done, type thing, but. I think they found out quite early that they were going to win the campaign, so they stopped spending money.
Right.
So, I mean, like, you know, 10 days before, they're going, doorsteps are so good, we don't need to spend any more money. But
present your ideas to him, or you just
get briefed? Like, you know, he would come in, there would be 8 of us in a room, and he's going, and it would be funny, he's going, like, hey, there's 9 of the brightest writers in London in this room, and there's, like, 8 of us, and so we'd always have a laugh, and he's going, like, you know, we need to crack this today. And he would be, him and Morris would be in the next room, you know, have their little spats with each other. And, you know, they're going, you know, you think bloody hell. Okay. But I mean, he was kind of, he would just look at something and he would, you know, he'd go and, he loves really pithy things. I mean, he was just going, yes, no.
Yeah.
He always would ask Fergus Fleming, what do you think?
Yeah, Jeremy
Sinclair was,
that was one of his favorite. Jeremy,
and, you know, Jeremy Sinclair was so bright and got to the point. And it was kind of interesting. You're there just going, wow, these guys, they're all at the top of the game, Jimmy.
So why did you leave? So did you leave just after the bank incident?
No, I left because we pitched for the Adidas count because, I mean, the backstory is, you know, Louis Dreyfus decided he wanted to buy Adidas.
And Louis Dreyfus was at Saatchi's at the time.
He was CEO of Saatchi's.
Yeah.
And I always kind of thought he was the coolest guy anyway. You know, wore jeans, was apparently going out with Kim Basinger, and then came in one day and said, I'm going to buy Adidas. And I'm going, oh, my God. And I think, you know, like, I think Charles and Morris and him had fallen out over something. And so, you know, we were never going to win the Adidas pitch. And, you know, I mean, I spent, like, months working on it, as did other people. And we literally didn't, we weren't going to win it. And so, I mean, and then at that point, I just gone, well, I kind of really, I sort of rediscovered, you going, God, that's the thing now. Yeah, you know, that's the thing that really kind of makes me come alive. And so then I thought, well, okay, who's won the account? Right, how do I get a job there?
Oh, really? So it was that calculated?
Yeah, took me a big pay cut to go there.
Did you? How did that come about? What, you got in touch with Tim or you spoke to headhunters?
Oh, no, I think, like, Tony Barry was at that point going, like, you know, I could get this job at this place and I'm not sure about it. And I'm going, oh, okay. I mean, it, you know, as you know, didn't have the best reputation for being, you know, the happiest place in the world.
Yeah, it's very quiet.
But I'm going, but they just won the Adidas account and I'm going, okay, it doesn't really matter if it's what it's like. We'll put up with it. And you know, so it was just the intention of, you know, just go and work on the Adidas thing and, you know, and see where that went.
So you came in and went for an interview with Tim and did you say, I'd love to work on Adidas, or you just went for
it? Tim wasn't that interested in, I mean, he wanted Tony Barry and, you know, that was the person he wanted. And, you know, and he said to Tony, go and find a partner. And, you know, two writers together wasn't, you know, it was an interesting experiment. I don't know if it worked. I'm not sure it did. But, I mean, you know, Tim, yeah, I mean, Tim wasn't that interested in hiring me, but he was hiring, he wanted to hire Tony. And I'm going, I don't really get, you know, I don't care. I'm just going, I just want to work on the Adidas thing.
Interesting. From where you started pinning up the poster. So what did you find when you worked on Adidas?
Well, I mean, like, you know, like Tim, right? I mean, he's a very smart writer. I mean, you know, like, but, you know, did he truly understand the Adidas account? Probably, you know, he was too, he wanted to make it too much like Nike. I mean, kind of maybe muddy the water. And I'm going, I think, you know, some of the things that you did, like, started to find quite a unique voice, you know, like, you know, just the lamppost and the A to B thing. I think then they were starting to find a voice. And, you know, he should have done much more of that stuff. Do you mean, like, more soulful? Like, but I don't know if, I mean, Tim's a very intelligent guy, so nobody's ever going to say he's not. But I just, I think sport is a very emotional thing, isn't it? It's like, it's not like the higher intelligence and emotional intelligence. But I mean, so I mean, I kind of found it pretty interesting. Also, I was just going, oh God, yeah, I wanna do this more. I mean, I'm not the, you know, I admire Tim for his ability to write. I don't think he's the best manager in the world. It wasn't super fun experience, but it was super important for me.
In what sense?
Well, because, I mean, all the ads, he didn't buy. I rolled them up and I started Howie's.
Yeah.
So if he'd bought them, then I wouldn't have any stuff to start Howie's with. And it gave me, like, I was interested in, you know, I think there's an interesting voice here. I think we can go and do this, start on T-shirts and, you know, like that became like really, you know, like it sort of got Howie's started. So
did that idea came about because you couldn't get work through Tim?
Yeah.
So literally, I mean, that. So you thought, that's interesting. There must be a way through.
Yeah. And I mean, things. I mean, you know, Tim offered me the chance to go and be creative director in, in Ligas at San Francisco, which would only mean like having a further like distance away from like just faxing him as I would blow out. So yeah. I was going, I might as well stay in London to do that.
Rather than getting rejected live, you're getting rejected via fax.
Yeah. And so it was kind of like an interesting time. You did some brilliant ads, and I still tell everybody about the ads you did there. And I remember literally going for a run, and you were saying about just the lamppost. I'm going, jeez, that's. I remember when Arden like saw the Benetton poster, and he just go, oh my God, like he was like devastated because he knew how good it was. And running, going, God, that ad is going to be amazing. And I didn't even know how it looked. I mean, but I knew it would be like on point. So I think for all of us, it was an interesting experience. It was, I wouldn't ever say it was easy.
I mean, it's interesting that I didn't realise Howie's had grown exactly out of that experience. I mean, I remember because I was involved in Howie's for about a week, week and a half. And I remember, obviously, there were some of the rejected ads. I can remember Scars Make Better Stories Than Tattoos and Life for a Limited Period and Only in Others.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can remember that you would boldly sneak out of the agency to go to BMX meets.
Yeah.
Which wasn't really Tim's vibe. People accommodating that thing. And I thought, God, I'm just going to get fired if I do that. Plus, I didn't want to go to BMX meets. But but it's interesting to kind of see a voice coming through on the work that isn't being taken up by Adidas and then think that feels like a brand, presumably, at that point.
And there are things, I mean, like, voices are, like, they're hard. Like, you can write an ad, but, like, can you create a voice? I mean, Dan Wyden, like, is, Wyden Kennedy is still independent, still, working with Nikes. And the compound interest of voice that they've created for Nike, like, has been, and ultimately that's why they're ahead of Adidas, because of the voice they created. I just think that thing of doing a voice for a company, a brand, is the hardest thing to do in advertising.
Yeah.
Because it's so hard, it's so unique. And Dan Wyden created it. Adidas haven't had it. And, they should have won.
Adidas should have won. What felt at the time?
Well, I mean, no, I think they had 90% of the market, right? I mean, it was long before, before we started writing on it. It was the Ian Potter of the world. It was the Dan Wyden of the world. Gave him that voice, and they captured people's, that 18 inches from your head to your heart. I mean, it's the longest journey for a brand to take, and very few brands take you on that journey, and Nike did because it made you feel something. But Adidas had everything to lose. They had 90% of the market. It's pretty hard to go from complete monopoly on the market almost. Yeah. Some of the stuff you were doing was starting to find a voice for Adidas, and I think they should have gone more and done more of that stuff. I think that would have been really interesting for Adidas then.
Well, I think at the time Nike was very glitzy and a little bit gaudy and brash, wasn't it? So trying to find a more soulful thing
felt
like a thing to do.
Yeah.
But I remember also you got made to write lots of long copy Harrods.
Yeah.
Which was obviously a sign of...
just the worst. I mean, I'm kind of like... I think maybe it's a good discipline and learning to write and stuff. And I mean, Tim's... he can knock that stuff off in his sleep. strength. You know,
yeah.
He's a great copywriter. He just, you know, like, you know, but in terms of building a team, you know, you just don't want to be around him. Which is a shame, right? Because he should have an incredible, successful agency, independent, doing great work, because he's one of the best copywriters there's ever been. But having, you know, it's that talent stack, isn't it? You go, oh, yes, you're a writer. Can you be a human being and look after people?
Yeah.
You need many things to run an agency.
Well, that felt like you were being punished, right? These long puppy Harrods ads. You must have learned something. It must have been useful in some way in retrospect, but punishment.
I think it was a hard time. You know, like, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, the thing is, if I didn't go there, I wouldn't have started Howie's. So I'm there going, it was like super useful to me. It wasn't an easy journey. And, you know, like, you know, he has his ways, which was, you know, but it wasn't, for me, it's not the way you build a team, build a company. And, we didn't get on. So, and that's fine.
So do you think do you think you learned a lot, even if it's what not to do or?
Yeah, no, I think like how not to treat people, how to build a team, how to like build, like that thing of where hard work, you know, is made harder when the atmosphere is like not great. So a lot of stuff, and also the thing of, I learned that, you know, actually, you know, I loved doing the Adidas thing because I was a thing, and actually all those ads I got bombed out meant I went and did Howie's doing it.
Yeah.
And you know, that was an interesting journey, but I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't gone to Ligas. I mean, in some ways, I'm super thankful to Tim. I mean.
So you leave to go to work with David Abbott?
Yeah.
Who is a different kind of manager?
Oh, completely.
So how did that come about?
Well, I was kind of getting to the point where I'm going, actually, you know, nothing I write is, you know, getting anywhere. And I was there going, well, I was kind of interested at that point, going, well, I can go and start Howie's and find somewhere, like, you know, easier to work, get paid a lot more money, and have more time to go and do the Howie's thing. All these big bars, they're all competitive. So David, like, I didn't get a chance to resign. David Abbott phoned Tim up and said, you know, I'm going to take David.
You'd obviously met David.
Yeah, and David was just a gentleman, and he had a great sense of humor, and was always super respectful of people, and it was like, it was chalk and cheese. I mean, it was literally, I mean, I'm like super fond of that time with him. And when we moved buildings, I was like literally, you know, I mean, I worked with a really fantastic talent, Rob Oliver, so we were two Welsh guys in the office. And when we moved, like, we were next door to him.
To David, yeah.
Yeah, and so he'd done the office plan. So in some respects, he was like a real, like, endorsement. He quite liked us.
Yeah.
But he was... He was absolutely brilliant. Like David Abbott and Paul Arden, like, for me, oh my God, they are like, you know, like very, very special people in the advertising world. It was a real like pleasure. And actually, the funny thing is, I was so like focused on like doing Howie's, like, I got relaxed on the advertising, and actually the more relaxed I got on it, the more success we had with it.
In the sense that weren't stressing, you were just kind
of... Yeah, no, I was just kind of, we'll do it. I worked with a guy called Rob Oliver. He was a real talent. I mean, he had some brilliant ideas, and I mean, I was just like, you know, I was lucky to be in that room with him. So it was, and, you know, we pitched for the COI business, and I think they, Abbott Mead pitched 17 times for it. And not won it. And then, so me and Rob did some work and we won it. And so, like, Abbott came into the room where he was, like, literally like a little kid.
Wow. So which bit did you pitch for? Drink Drive or?
I think we pitched for both, but we won Kill Your Speed.
Right.
But they were literally bounded into the room. And it was like, you know, like, I mean, it meant something to them. You know, they'd done it, I don't know, 17 times, if that's the exact figure, but it was close to that. But I mean, it was just you go and present him work and he would think about it and we'd talk and it was just so civil. It was literally, yeah, you going, oh my God. Well, that's what it's like. You know, it's different to Paul. It was very instinctive, but he knew how to build, like, and look after people. It was very interesting to watch.
So you took a lot away from David.
Oh,
presumably.
Yeah, and like how not to do it, how to do it, building a space where people can do the best work they've ever done. You know, is something that I'm fascinated by, and building those cultures where you know, creative people can, you know, like, you know, go and show the world what they can do. I think that's pretty interesting.
So you've gone from somewhere that both worked in a different way, but somewhere that tries to get you to do your best work through fear, and somewhere that tries to get you to do your best work through confidence. Presumably, and obviously you preferred the latter.
And Abbott would always say, you know, flowers bloom in the sunshine. And I'm going, yeah, they do. And, you know, if you look at Dan Wyden, you know, like, it's, you know, like, he hires creative people and lets them fly. And he trusts them. Like fear, yeah, you can get some stuff out of people, but actually long term it's not the most creative environment. I mean, you know, you have to be pretty loose to do the best work you've ever done.
So when you went to Abbott Mead, the thing in the back of your head was, I'm going to develop Howies. This is a sort of stop off to that.
Yeah.
How long were you at Abbott Mead in the end? 3 years?
I don't know. I should know, but I think maybe I would say 5 years. I mean,
was
it
that long?
I don't know. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know. I'd have to check, actually. I think it was, yeah, maybe around that time. But I sort of kept getting pay rises and they put me on the board and, you know, it was like, oh, okay. But all the time, they had this massive, heavy-duty photocopier, and I was hitting it on a Friday night, and I was doing the Howie's catalogues.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. I'd heard that you used to do the early catalogues on their photocopier.
Yeah, and, like, I could see the bar. They were all in the bar Friday night. I was hitting this thing, like, so hard. And, I'm sure I shortened his life. and as long as I did my job, and I was doing it well, and, you know, they give me nice pay rises. I was going, well, I'm going to hit that photocopier for all it's worth. And that's how we started the Howie's catalogue.
So what was the plan with the catalogue? Obviously, you're selling them off a page, but what was the...
I was kind of... it was funny. I mean, like, we'd built up, like, a really cool cult following BMX skateboard shops, and... I sort of learned how bad, like, you know, cotton was for the environment, and the only company doing organic cotton t-shirts was Patagonia. So I got in touch with Patagonia and gone, can I get hold of some, you know, cotton t-shirts? And and they're, and we've always had a good relationship with Patagonia, and they said yeah, and so I went and phoned all the shops in one morning, and I told the shops, going like this, the t-shirts are going to have to sell for £30 because they're going to be organic, and I'd lost every account in a day.
Wow.
And I remember going home, and Claire's going, how's your day? And I've gone, very efficient. Most people spend years trying to lose their business, and I did it in the morning. But at that point, so the only way to sell was to go and do a catalog.
In the sense of what, you could talk more, you had more of someone's time to explain.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to sell, and otherwise we'd have to not do organic t-shirts. And at the time, people hadn't got their head around organic milk. I mean, it was quite we were ahead of things, and we working with some guys doing our website, and they just come back from a conference and gone, the first thing they're going, you've got to get a blog. I'm going, what's a blog? And so we had the first blog for a brand, almost in, I think we were one of the, if not the first. I mean,
So what year are we talking? 2004?
I'm just trying to think. Four? I don't know. I have to, I'm terrible with dates, but I have to go and think about.
The thing that's interesting to me is this is very early on in when you're doing brochures and blogs.
Yeah.
People weren't talking that much about their products, and they didn't have many views. The whole idea of your purpose and all of the new names come up with these things, it wasn't around then that you should wang on about all your product details and what you think about the planet. Yeah, yeah. So you were very early on that.
Yeah, yeah.
So why was that? Why did you...
I think that writing all the Adidas thing, I kind of felt like there was a voice going on in, on this stuff. And the first ad we ever wrote of Harry's was, we want to make you think as well as buy. And that was the thing that I thought, oh, that's really interesting. If a company actually, we've got to sell T-shirts and things. Well, what if it made you think as well as buy? And it was kind of there wasn't too many people out there, with that set of thoughts. And we were just, it was kind of, we were learning. The whole Howie's thing was sort of slightly chaotic. We would go to work. We sort of started in 1995 and we got our first paycheck in 2001.
Wow.
And, But we would go, we met somebody, who's the beauty of coincidences. So we went snowboarding in Maribel. The chalet maid's boyfriend was a skateboarder. We met him when we came back. He then, by day would run Howie's. And then he resigned and he went. He said he's going to go and start something with this unknown illustrator from Bristol. And after 6 months, they stopped doing it. But the unknown illustrator was Banksy.
No, really?
And so clown skateboards that nobody knows about, Banksy, Jeff and Banksy were doing something together. And, but it didn't work. I don't know if you can get any clown skateboards now, but they couldn't sell them for £40.
Right. Wow.
And then, so he came back to work for me then. And, that was the whole chaos of how he was doing really interesting things. Because it didn't really have to be a business for the first 5 years, because I was just funding it with my salary. We just didn't care about very much.
So what was your goal then at that point? Just to carry on as you were going, or did you think at some point I'm going to jump ship?
And the interesting point, I was in Abbotsmead. I was doing really well. They put me on the board. They wanted me to send me on presentation courses because I didn't really want to go to meetings and stuff. And I was quite happy just writing.
Yeah.
And I picked up a magazine, and it was the top 50 brands in the UK. And I think, I don't know, again, I don't know if it's the exact figure, but it was something like this. You know, Adidas was 12th, Howie's was 9, and Nike was 6.
Right.
And I
was like, when you were still at Abbot Mead?
Still at Abbot Mead. And I was like, going, actually, I put the magazine down. And I said, look, to myself, I'm going, like, yeah, other people are taking Howie's much more seriously than I was. And maybe if I really wanted it to work, what I would have to do is go and give it my time. And I put the magazine down and I went home. I said, Claire, yeah, look, and things have gone well. She was had imagination, which was,
yeah,
you know, like a pretty interesting place, doing interesting things. And, yeah, we're having a nice life. We'd finally... You know, I was finally on some good money. You know, I was working with a very talented guy, working with in an agency that actually, you know, treated you as a human being. So it was good times. Except, you know, I really wanted to go and do something else. And so it was, you know, we had, you know, a glass of wine and just going, you know, and... we just had, you know, our first daughter, and just going, look, should we go and take a risk and, you know, move back to Wales and go and do this thing that we'd never done Howie's full time. Like, everybody else had done it but us. You know, we'd just done it on the weekends or in some holidays.
So you went in and resigned, presumably, within a week or so.
I mean,
so did you resign to David?
No, David had, I think that was part of that also thing, that David had left and, they'd made Peter Suter creative director. And you know, David, you know, was a pretty unique person, I mean, and I was like, I just felt lucky to learn from him. Do you mean, in the same way as I was lucky to learn from Paul Arden, and you just suck any information up or any learning you can have, and that had stopped then. And I mean, Peter Suter didn't really see eye to eye on stuff. And, you know, we did some Howie's ads, you know, with John Gore, so I thought they were pretty interesting. And then Peter decided he didn't want to enter him for DNAD. I'm going, okay, well, I don't really value what you think that much. So I paid for him to be entered, and actually they got in, and I bet him that, I said, you know, so, and he had to pay me the bet. You mean?
Well, So
I went snowboarding. I just went out, like, I'm not feeling this anymore. And I literally faxed my resignation letter. I said, like, I'm not going to come back. And, you know, like, I had a super great time. But they're going, you got to come back for a party. I'm going, yeah, sure, fine. I never did. But I had a good time there. It wasn't like, it was, and some really bright people, fantastic. And I felt lucky to have been there and worked under David, and, you know, it was, and there's some really good, talented people there. I mean,
So you resign, you're all on your own. What was your plan then for Howie's?
Well, I mean, I think I knew that we need to go in a bit full time. We'd never done that. So we moved back. We went to West Wales, which we got to know, you know, over 20 years of being there on holidays. But the plan was to go and let's go and build one of the best brands that I've ever been. And it was kind of, you know, we were doing some interesting things. We didn't really know how to run a business, and, you know, like, money was, like, you know, we were growing at 350% a year. It was just going crazy. And we kind of felt like after 2 or 3 years, we're going to actually, we either need to go and get some venture capital money, or we go and part partner with somebody who will build this thing long term. And actually, we were very lucky. I mean, we had Steve Case, who started AOL, through his company Revolution. They were going to invest $25-30 million if we'd moved to Ojai in California. Wow. But we'd only just moved back to West Wales, and we were just getting settled. And I mean, Claire was just going, look, as attractive as that is, we turned it down. But there were a lot of people like super interested, and in the end, we did a deal with Timberland just because they said they understood the importance of Wales. We had companies, a company called PPR, who I think they've changed the name since, but they own Gucci, Yves Saint Laurent, Stella McCartney, but also Puma. And they'd identified two companies they wanted to buy. One was Quiksilver and one was Howie's.
And what was it they wanted to buy, do you think? Why do you manage to make such a name for yourself?
They saw it as, they saw it as a more punky version of Patagonia.
Right.
And, and Patagonia, they have good relationships with them, and I went to visit them, and they do this thing called Footprint Chronicles, and apparently that came because of Howie's, and they acknowledged actually Howie's did some really interesting things, and they went and did them after that.
So I find it interesting, particularly what you say about Nike and the voice that Phil, what's his name? Well, Dan Wyden and the owner of Nike built. Because obviously your voice was the Howie's voice. I don't know how you measure these in terms of assets, but that was its biggest asset, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
If you put that on a spreadsheet, the voice that you built was disproportionately huge. I mean, there was an incident, and I don't know whether this carried down to you in Wales, but there was someone at BNP did a pitch, and they stole one of your monologues from your brochure wholesale and put it as the new client manifesto in this pitch. They won the pitch, and then not long after they'd won the pitch, the client was told, someone said, oh, that's from a Howie's brochure. And then the BNP guy was fired. I don't know if you've heard that.
God.
Someone
No, I didn't know.
And that wasn't uncommon. A lot of people were looking at that voice and that brand. And in fact, another good example is the guys from Innocent. Who came down pre-Innocent, I think, didn't they? And left with a voice, some ideas on how you brand the product. So, for example, I remember your jeans would say something like, I'm dirty, I need a wash, inside. And the kind of Innocent guys took that idea of sort of random fun messages in and around the product, and most people would think that was their thing because they became very well known from that, but that was taken wholesale. I mean, they seemed to take your signature. They took a whole bunch of things back with them when they left meeting. But where did that,
we started similar times, and I think it was that thing of it was a very interesting time because actually people hadn't done and that started talking like human beings, and it was kind of like, and having a bit of fun with stuff, and it was and all credit to Innocent. Dan used to write the bottles, and it's a funny thing. He's going, oh, do those words matter? On the label of a bottle of a smoothie, you go, yeah, actually, they did matter. And they continue to matter because, it's those mini connections that actually mean a lot. The Howie's thing, people all over the world going, oh, you did that. It was a very small, sometimes small, not in terms of business. It wasn't that big a business, but in terms of the like it seemed to strike a chord with lots of people in at that time. So its influence. I mean, like, you know, Patagonia doing the Footprint Chronicles, and you know, they changed the website like after we launched ours, because you know, we did like, this is the this is how far, you know, this product has traveled, you know, to get this. So the, you know, the, you know, the miles of a product hadn't been really considered before, and all those things. It was kind of it definitely had a moment.
So how, what, because they're at very different ends of the spectrum. One of them is quite worthy, although you can do it in a very friendly, nice way, and one of them is completely random, oddball. What's bringing those together?
I think that's a good question. I think it's, you know, that, like, you know, the, you can feel the human behind them. And I think that, you know, like any voice, is like, you know, can you, is there a human behind it, and you connect with that human being? I think that's the thing that's always sort of guided me. And I think, you know, Patagonia, you can tell, you know, Yvonne and Melinda, you know, care deeply about the environment, and are using their company to, like, you know, as a tool, you know, to make the change that they want to see in the world. And, you know, and we, with Howie's thing, it was, you know, that thing of, you know, we do want you to make you think, but we also believe in infotainment. And, you know, if we bore you, you're not going to think too much. And so there was a level of irreverence there.
That's interesting, because I remember when we started working with you, DHM, doing work for Howie's, and we did a campaign that I really liked, which was on denim, and then we were about to do some more stuff on merino, and I think I developed stuff in the same vein that we'd all liked from the previous stuff, and you said, oh, it's just similar to the last stuff, why don't we start again, do something completely different, which is such an odd thing for a client, as you were to say, just no, it just doesn't have to feel like the last stuff, it's just do a different thing, in which we did all this sort of illustrated stuff. But somehow there's a, it's not as random as it appears. Let's just be different. Let's try.
No.
I don't know what's connecting all of those things, whether that's your impatience with, or sort of anti-corporate feel. I don't know what it is.
I think, like, you can, I think we, like, if you look at Nike, there's, if you have a strong voice, you can take it in lots of different directions. And I think, because there's always, you know, something to come back to. And I think sometimes, you know, we in terms of advertising, it's, you can, you know, be freer with it. And I think it's, you know, you can go and put it over there, and, you know, like, and it's still, over the long term, the voice is just finding different executions for that voice. And I think we can be freer in terms of the executions, but the voice is pretty consistent. And I think, you know, that's, you know, that's what I'm kind of interested in. I think, you know, it's we can be more free. And, you know, as you know, the internet has changed, you know, like things for advertising and stuff, but it's still, you still got to find a voice, and you've got a different delivery system.
Yeah. I think that's coming back.
Yeah.
The idea that you need a voice and you need to connect with people rather than just dealing with data, but...
And I think, like, I mean, we, you know, like anything, we, you know, we have a new toy, we play it to death, and we're going to go, oh, hang on, this toy's a bit boring now. Because you still need something to stand out, you still need something to resonate, you still need something to connect. You just got a different delivery system, fine, you know, get over it. You still need to, you need to make a connection with a human being. And you can do it through the head, you can do it through your heart, you know, but that journey from your head to your heart is the hardest one.
So I think the thing with the voice, which is quite interesting, I think that all of the things you've done, and obviously you've done them with Claire. I don't want to cut Claire out, but I'm talking to you. They're very you. And your voice is, like, I'm trying to think of you being furious. Like, you said you didn't have a great time at Legas. I can't remember you being down, angry, shouty.
Oh, no.
So, hard, and that comes over in all of, whether it's how we do lectures, Hyatt Denham, it feels a very upbeat, optimistic, we can make this better kind of thing. So it's not like an invented marketing voice.
Yeah, I mean, but that's my viewpoint on the world. I'm going to, like, you know, life is short, and you just go, like, let's go and make everything as good as we can. And even the hard times, sometimes the worst of times, you need the worst of times for the best of times. And, like, literally, if I didn't have gone to Legas, I mean, I learned, like, so much there. I mean, it wasn't an easy time, but it was, like, God, like... I mean, at Saatchi's, we had 6 weeks to write a campaign, and in Legas, we had a day.
Yeah.
And it was tough, you know, I mean, you know. But I wouldn't have started Howie's if I hadn't gone there. And so, like, it was one of the best things that ever happened to me. It wasn't the easiest thing, but it was definitely one of the best things.
Yeah. I suppose my...
I do think the sense of optimism and I believe in that. And,
well, I suppose that's my point, really, is because when we talk about you need to create a voice and the voice of the brand, a lot of it can feel very marketing-y. It can sound like deceitful, in a way. How do we bundle up this brand so that it feels very X or Y? Whereas I think your genuine voice as a human being comes through in those brands. It's not like... You know, to some degree, there are some other innocent or some other brands feel like they've created a persona that seems appealing to appeal to people, whereas yours feels like you. It doesn't feel created. It feels like you. Now, either that's because you're very good at deceiving or because it's very you, which I would think it's the latter. But
I think the thing for me is, like, actually, if you speak to Dan... who actually is now at Apple, but yeah, when you spoke to him, he was literally that guy who'd write that label. Yeah. I mean, like, if you didn't know, you'd be going, "Oh my God, that's Dan." And so, and I think you know, like, for me, I'm going, like, I love brands that you literally feel there's a human behind it, and actually, yeah, sometimes, you know, in advertising and marketing, you know, they write that stuff to imagine that person exists, but they doesn't really exist, and therefore is very inconsistent. But if you do have the human being behind it, then it can actually be very consistent. And actually, that's what creative direction is about. You know, that's why you know, it's putting that consistency in. But I think, I always kind of feel like, you know, they're going to, you know, after we did Howie's, going, well, how are you going to go and do that stuff because it was so personal. I'm going, well, but I've evolved now as well. So, you know, but I'm still going to take my voice with me, but I've learned a lot.
So how tough was it to leave Howie's, given that the DNA is all over Howie's, your DNA, and you've got to extract yourself from that?
It
must have been tough.
It was incredibly tough. And, you know, we did a deal with some people who said they, you know, really understood how important Wales was, and then a year later, you know, they wanted to move all aspects of business elsewhere, and you're going, wow, okay. So that was, it was like a very low point, because, and I tried to buy it back, and I had, you know, like I said, I had PPR, who owned Gucci and Yves Saint Laurent, you know, they were going to help me. So at the point, you know, Timberland were for sale. I didn't know they were for sale, and they wouldn't entertain me buying it back. And so I had no choice but to leave. And it was really hard, because I tell you why it was hard. It was because, you know, the mission was like half complete. Mm. We'd done some really interesting things, but we were about to do some really amazing things. And, you know, then, like, you know, I'm the fan of Phil Knight. I'm the fan of Ali Dassler. And I was there going, God, we can go and do some really interesting things. And we half got there. So it was like a real disappointment. And I wasn't angry with Timberland or whatever. I was just angry with myself because I was there going, like, you know, next time round, don't fuck it up. And I phoned, had a phone call with, arranged a phone call with Yvonne at Patagonia. And, you know, we'd nearly done something with them, so we got to know them a bit, not personally, but... And I said to him, I said, look, Yvonne, you know, I'm going to go again and do something else, but I need to know some things. I said, like, how did you keep hold of Patagonia?
Hmm.
And he laughed, and he said, well, you know, 40 years hard work. I'm going, yeah, I thought as much. And he said, oh, and the second point, two remortgages. I'm going, oh, yeah.
All right.
And so, you know, it was like, yeah, leaving Howie's was the worst of times, but actually he's also now presented us with the best of times, and Hyatt's pretty incredible. You know, we make, you know, an amazing pair of jeans. We have people who have such great skills, and this town has all this incredible knowledge of making jeans. And, you know, I mean, come the end of next month, there'll be 25 of us. The aim is to try and get 400 people their jobs back. You go, yeah, and people go, oh, is that possible? And then it's not impossible. It might just be hard. And we haven't done anything in terms of, you know, like marketing or advertising that we want to do yet, because we've been so busy, you know, like first 3 years making sure you survive. And, you know, just move factories to, a place three times as big, and you go, wow, okay. And so I just think we're at that point where you go, God, we're, you know, we could go and do very interesting things now. And we haven't done very much on The Voice. And that's been a, like, you know, starting a factory is not easy. And, you know, running a factory gets you busy and stuff. And I just think, God, we got to the starting line. And you go, that's pretty interesting.
So in terms of Howie's and Hyatt, what did Howie's teach you not to do again, and what did it teach you to do again?
I think, you know, like, Howie's taught me to, like really focus on, like, you know, try, you know, do one thing well. And, you know, for us, it's like, we're going to make jeans. We're not interested in anything else. We're going to really focus on that. And that was, a big learning. I think sometimes, I mean, you know, Simon came down before he started Rafa, and you know, we gave him all a list of factories and stuff, and he said, look, we're just going to make cycling gear for cyclists. And I'm going, yeah, you'll do well. And he has done well. And I think for us, it's going, like, you know, there's enough, you know, creative people out there, you know, for us to go and get 400 people their jobs back. And so, you know, the one learning is, like, you know, real sheer focus.
I read a quote saying, be narrow.
Yeah, completely. And just go, like, literally be narrow, you know, be focused, say no to all the things that other people want you to go and do because they think you will do really well. And then the second thing is build a team. Build a culture, and then, you know, and the third thing is go and make the world feel something for what you're doing, and actually we haven't done that much work on that thing yet. We've been so busy, like, make the product amazing, build a team, and so now, you know, we're at that interesting point where you're going, okay, you know, I think we can go and do interesting things now.
And what would you not do that you did? It? Do you think with Howie's you were too wide, or you listened to too many
wide,
people, or
I
what?
Mean, I think, I mean, also, I mean, the other thing is, like, oh, go and learn how to run a business.
Yeah, so that was good practice.
Yeah, the dry run. Thing of, like, looking after the monies. We've been profitable last three, four years, I think probably 4 years. And so, we don't have to go hunting for money. Do you mean? And also that patients are going like, it took Yvonne, a long time to build Patagonia. You be patient, it's fine.
Yeah.
We make a great pair of jeans. We want to sell them to great people. Apply some patience. Great brands are not built in a quarter, and 3 years, and just go in every day and go like, how do we get better today than we were yesterday? And if we literally ask that question each day, we won't have to worry about anything. And also there's not many distractions around here. I mean, like, we don't get too many. We've got a fair few film crews, admittedly, but I mean, like, there's not that many people come down for meetings. We just got like, get focused. Let's go and build this thing. Great team. We're trying to hire more grandmasters. And actually making something. Seeing a roll of salvaged denim come from Japan, and then we cut it and we sew it, and it leaves as a pair of jeans, is pretty amazing. I mean, like, seeing like something get made by people with such great skills, and you go, it's kind of you go, all we have to do is tell the world about it.
Yeah. So I've got to pull you up on one thing. So do one thing well. So far, you're making jeans, you're publishing books, you're running lectures.
Yeah.
You're not really doing one thing.
Not doing well. I mean, that's what Tessa.
So where does lectures fit into this?
Well, actually, Patagonia invited me to their tools camp when I was running Howie's, and they do this thing once every 2 years, and they invite 80 people, and they go and give them the tools to lobby environmental causes. And I thought, God, that's such an extraordinary thing to do as a company. And I said, look, I literally can't come. I can't get to you on that date. I said, don't worry, I'll watch them, online. And they're going, we don't film them. I'm going to go, that's a shame. Also inspired by Tony Davidson, who sent me a text, around about the same time. And it was like, don't just stand there, do something.
After Howie's.
Yeah, and, Dick Dastardly, and I was there going, So we thought, okay, let's go and do a lecture series of people doing extraordinary things, and we'll do that. And it was never meant to be more than a one-off event. There was no plan. It was like, it was a happy accident. And here we are, 10 years in. And but people go, you're doing books. I'm going, well, actually, Miranda's runs the book company. I mean, I have a phone call with her maybe once a month. I don't do very much. If there's one thing I do is try and build teams. And build that team around something that we want to change. And you go, okay, let's go and get our town thriving. Let's get those 400 world-class makers, back to where their skills are. There's a lot going on. But it's kind of interesting. I feel very lucky to be living where I want, doing what I want, working with people I want to work with, and just seeing how good can we get at this thing? Rather than how big we can get at this thing, I just think if we drive the desire to go and be really good at it, then the consequence of that is we'll probably get big at it. And I always kind of think, we we don't set a target of like, oh, let's go and grow this company by this. Let's set a company by how good can we get this thing? You know, for a pair of jeans, we make a great pair of jeans. But it's also like, how low impact can we be? How, you know, inventive can we be? And so it's a, you know, like a series of experiments, and you get to play them out each day, and you go, okay, that's pretty interesting. But the do is like a, you know, like the tickets go on sale on March the 1st, and they sell out in an hour.
I mean, wow. It's and like, the books look like they're doing well too. They're everywhere.
Yeah, no, Miranda's just so, signed a contract with Chronicle Books, who apparently are one of the best publishers in America. And so you go, God, that's pretty interesting. And a £1.2 billion events company came to us and said, look, we really love the do lectures. And I went, yeah, so do I. And they're going, like, shall we talk? Which also means, other words, they want to buy you. And I went to London, and they're going, we got a term sheet, and I'm going, look, just so you know, like, whatever the number is on that piece of paper, I'm not interested. Like, I mean, it's nice to, you're nice people. But my children would never speak to me again if we sold the do.
Yeah.
And they're going, oh, are you sure you don't want to know? I'm going, like, I definitely don't want to know.
For you. So I've got to ask then, one of the questions I would ask is, how much of what you learnt in advertising has been useful now? But part of me thinks, and I didn't know that early, I didn't know about that early 13-year-old with his posters and his shoe contacts. And yeah. Part of it feels like a very straight evolution from that 13-year-old to where you are now. And advertising was a stop-off rather than it,
Yeah, but I think it was like being around, like advertising is like one of the best universities because, I mean, you go to university just to hang out with really bright people, the degree, fine, whatever. But like, you are the sum total of, the smart people you hang up with. And that's what advertising, like, with yourself or, the John Pants of the world, all these amazing, like, people, like, and some of the brightest brains, the brightest thinkers, the brightest strategists, and you're going, oh my God, I just learned, like, such incredible communication tools. And you suddenly go, and so advertising is the best university in the world if you want to go and start, like, companies, brands, and, filmmakers or whatever. It's just, that melting pot of crazies and, like, thinkers and, like, change makers. And you go, oh, my God, it is. Like, for me, it was just like incredible. I literally loved it. I mean, I remember went out to New York and worked in New York for 6 months with Ajab and,
In Saatchi's, yeah.
Yeah, and Saatchi's just bought some agency, and at that point, they were like suddenly the biggest, advertising agency in the world, and you go, wow. And, Arden had given us $500 to go and buy some interesting books, and I'm going, God, this is mad. And when we came back, all he wanted to know is, "Where's the books?"
Oh, you had to buy the books for him.
Yeah,
yeah.
And he kept the interesting ones. You're around those people. The Graham Finks of the world, the Jeremy Clarks, and. Like, literally, just people are just going, like, they're, seeing where their ideas can go. Do you mean? And you go, God, it's like, there's no other place like it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I haven't worked in it for a long time, but, and I'm sure everyone's saying it's changed, but I think that's still true. Do you mean? I would imagine it's true.
Do you see many ads nowadays that you get excited about, or you have the same feeling for, or brands even?
Like, now and again, I guess your kids, they suddenly go and, you know, like when your kids forward you an ad, you go and like, you know, why isn't Hyatt doing this? And like, you know, like Tessa, my youngest, like forward me like the Nike London film. And
yeah, that's
like,
great. Yeah.
You should be doing this. Why aren't you doing this?
She's got good taste. Like,
yeah, okay, yeah, fine. So, I mean, there's still, you know, I think it's, I mean, I think, you know, like, I think rather than, you know, people have been really down on advertising, I think it's probably even more important now to be able to communicate than ever.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think, you know, I think it's interesting times.
Yeah. Okay, Dave, that was great, very inspiring. I think you're in an unusual camp of from people I've worked with who've completely set their own path. You know, we were talking ironically with Peter Suter, who you talked fondly of earlier, who said, who do you think's done the best in advertising? And we were trying to think of different names. Some different names were kicked around. But in a way, I think you have, because you've sort of completely followed your own path. You know, most of the people we were kicking around were people who'd started up agencies and made X million pounds. But
you
seem to have completely carved out your own idiosyncratic, personal, done it all on your terms. So
yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's, I mean, and advertising is a great springboard to for the, you know, people to go and do that stuff. And I think... I do feel like sort of blessed and grateful just to go, okay, let's go and see what we can do today.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't, like, I'm grateful to have worked in advertising. I'm grateful to have worked with all those like super bright people, even if they didn't, if they taught me how not to do things.
Yeah.
So I do feel, you know, I'm sort of lucky and you know, like, remember that run? And you tell me about that ad. I'm going, that was like, I just went, wow, that's so. That was such a truth.
Rejected by Tim, that one.
Well, I mean, you know, Tim. To be fair, I mean, I don't know if he got it. And I, you know, like, you know, on that week when he went away, all those ads got run, and actually they all won awards. And you go, yeah. But it. To have that truth is you have to, that was like that, you know, those ads you did were seminal to me.
You're very kind. Okay, Dave, that's great.
Okay, man.
Thank you. Thanks for your time. I'll speak to you soon. Pleasure. I'm going to chase you and try and get some ads from you that you've done. I've got a lot of them, but we'll try and find the others.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Thanks again, Dave. Great to talk to you. Bye.
All right. Bye.